Malaysia has not yet determined a cause of death for North Korean half-brother Kim Jong-un. It's Wednesday, February 22nd. This is VOA Asia. Hello, I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Welcome. Also ahead, another call for Rohingya aid. Cambodia opposition party has a new leader. Is China's investment bank making a difference? And the Chinese robotic workforce. It's all coming up on today's VOA Asia. Malaysian authorities on Tuesday said they have yet to determine the cause of death in the case of the half-brother of North Korean leader Kim Jong-un, who died under mysterious circumstances February 13th while at Kuala Lumpur International Airport. Prime Minister Najib Razak said on Monday that the investigation will be impartial, but North Korea's ambassador has denounced it as politically motivated. Grainy closed-circuit video released by Japanese broadcaster Fuji TV appeared to show Kim Jong-nam approached by two women. One allegedly wiped his face with what is suspected to be poison. Kim, who had been living in Chinese-controlled Macau, died on his way to the hospital. VOA Vietnamese reporters spoke with Don Van Than, the father of one of the detained women.
I don't know anything, but the government already knew. What can I do now? It's hard to say what I can do now. I want to meet with my daughter, but the government is investigating. I don't even know who I should turn to get help. So I would say let the government investigate.
He said she was home for Lunar New Year celebrations, but after that, had no idea of her whereabouts.
I couldn't know what she did. We can't. She didn't even let us know where she goes. She did get home on the 28th, 2 days before the Lunar New Year, and left 4 days after. She left, and we know nothing since then. What she did and how she did it, we couldn't know either. That's the reality. She's a good and hard-working girl. She's not a bad girl. The bottom line is we didn't know where she went. We can't.
South Korea has said it is nearly certain Kim was assassinated by North Korean agents. Malaysian police have four people in custody and are seeking others. Malaysia analyst James Chin of Australia's University, Tasmania, tells VOA's Victor Beatty that while the investigation has caused strains between Malaysia and North Korea, he doubts the case will cause permanent rupture.
I think what you're seeing is just ripples in the relationship. For the Malaysian side, this is a straightforward criminal investigation about the murder of a foreign national on Malaysian soil. For the North Korean, of course, it's much more important and sensitive, because the victim is the stepbrother of the current ruler. But for both sides, I think they will take a step back after the whole thing is finalized, and I don't think there's any danger of them breaking up relations.
Well, Malaysia's been put in kind of a tough spot, hasn't it, given this investigation and involving a lot of players?
Yes, well, I think for the Malaysian side, they will treat it basically as a criminal case. In other words, they'll look at it purely from the point of view that a foreign national was murdered at a Malaysian airport. They'll do their very best to find out how the victim was killed. Was it by poison or by chemical or by some other stuff? And on the other hand, I think what they'll do eventually is that they will have to release the body to the North Koreans.
Will Malaysia conduct any follow-up legal proceedings in court, for instance?
Highly unlikely, for the very simple reason that it's quite obvious that the people who planned the murder is based in a foreign country, in this case, North Korea. And also some of the major operatives have already left Malaysia. And the latest report coming out of Kuala Lumpur is that the people who actually carry out the assassination are actually back in Pyongyang.
However he died, will those who attacked him go free, do you think?
Well, I think if they're going to charge somebody for the murder, obviously they're going to charge the two ladies who were caught within 24 hours. And I'm talking about the Indonesian lady and another lady from Vietnam. Other than that, I don't think it'll go further up the chain.
James, North Korea and Malaysia have an interesting relationship. It's one of North Korea's few friends in Asia.
North Korea does have relations with other countries in Southeast Asia. It's just that the North Koreans have been using the embassy in Kuala Lumpur as the main base operation for the region.
How are they doing that? What are they doing?
Well, I think one of the things they're doing in Malaysia is that Malaysia, as you know, is a fairly open society. So basically, I think they're using Malaysia for getting around a lot of the sanctions against the North Koreans. For example, one of the sanctions they face is that they don't have access to the international financial system. So I think Malaysia is one of the places where they can send money in and out from Korea.
Malaysia's health minister has indicated autopsy results of the victim could be released as early as Wednesday. These are among the top Asia stories trending on voanews.com. Suicide attack on Pakistani courthouse kills 7. Small plane crashes into Australian mall, 5 believed dead. Philippines says ASEAN hopes for clear picture on Trump policies. Region in China's restive Xinjiang to track vehicles as anti-terror measure. Indian lawmaker seeks to trim the big fat Indian weddings. You'll find expanded coverage of these stories and more on Facebook at VOA Asia and on our voanews.com website. VOA Asia continues. The UN's top human rights official, Zeid Ra'ad Al Hussein, is urging Myanmar's leader, Nobel laureate Aung San Suu Kyi, to use her moral authority to ease the plight of the country's disenfranchised Rohingya Muslim community. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from the High Commissioner's headquarters in Geneva.
Myanmar leader Aung San Suu Kyi has come under mounting criticism from the international community for her failure to speak out on behalf of the Rohingya, a persecuted Muslim minority in Myanmar's Rakhine state. But there are signs this may be changing. Ravina Shamdasani is spokeswoman for the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights. She tells VOA the High Commissioner spoke personally to Aung San Suu Kyi on the phone earlier this month. This was after the release of an investigative report that documents alleged atrocities committed by Myanmar's military against the Rohingya.
She was quite shocked to hear the details of these findings, and she said that she would have to initiate an investigation. They would need more evidence. The High Commissioner asked her to use all her moral standing to bring this counterinsurgency operation to an end.
About 69,000 Rohingya have fled to neighboring Bangladesh since October 9th, following an oppressive military operation in Rakhine State. UN investigators interviewed 220 of these people who described acts of unbearable cruelty, including mass gang rapes, killings, and disappearances. Shamdasani says the High Commissioner understands the new government has a difficult balancing act in this period of transition. But she adds, he believes the violence and suffering of the Rohingya has reached an unprecedented level, and Suu Kyi must use her moral authority.
It is very important that people hear signals from the very top that this kind of behavior is not acceptable and that there will be accountability. It may be too soon to say whether this will be the ultimate breakthrough for the Rohingya in Myanmar, but we believe it is heading in that direction. There is a momentum towards a breakthrough on this issue.
In what could be a harbinger of better things to come for the Rohingya, Myanmar has ended its military operation in Rakhine State this week. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Happening now in Asia, China will ban the manufacture and sale of 4 variations of the synthetic drug fentanyl starting March 1st, a move that U.S. Drug Enforcement Administration officials call a game changer for the United States' battle with manufactured opioids. Beijing and Washington held 6 months of talks on the issue. Stay up to date with VOA. We're happy you're with us today on VOA Asia. As Kem Sokha assumes leadership of the Cambodian National Rescue Party, he is expected to deliver a very different type of political approach following Sam Rainsy's resignation and a raft of threats from Prime Minister Hun Sen. Mild-mannered, with a focus on village economics and social issues, Kem Sokha has eschewed the extravagant lifestyles of Cambodia's political elites, commonly referred to as Khmer Rouge, preferring more modest values that have endeared him to rural voters. Whether that's enough to unseat Hun Sen in general elections next year will be tested in just 4 months, when thousands of local village posts are contested at commune elections, primarily between the CNRP and the ruling Cambodia People's Party. Sam Rainsy's decision to quit was made after Hun Sen announced that he would introduce legislation banning people with criminal convictions from leading political parties. And according to Sam Rainsy, that would have resulted in the dissolution of the CNRP. The government has denied allegations of cheating at elections and insists its courts are impartial. Ren Chanrath, a political coordinator at the Youth Resource Development Program, said legal posturing was aimed at preventing Sam Rainsy from contesting the June 4th commune and general elections, but his resignation would only inspire Kem Sokha and the CNRP faithful.
The resignation of Mr. Sam Rainsy just make the opposition party become stronger, and their activity and supporter will do more to get successful in the upcoming election. So, you know, they will do more.
CNRP advocate Van Thorn said Sam Rainsy's resignation was disappointing, but it was necessary to save the party and position the opposition ahead of the commune elections, where he expects Kem Sokha will do well.
If you can move to the state of the commune council elections, I'm kind of sure that CNRP will run a lot of seats, and this will help CNRP move ahead toward the national election. Because generally in at the countryside, almost everywhere in Cambodia, people now are more interested in the politics. People now are getting fed up with the current leadership of the government, so they only wait for the election day to come.
Sam Rainsy's resignation took many by surprise, including Billy Chia Lung Tai, an independent human rights consultant at CL Consulting, who suggests there might have been some discontent with his performance within CNRP ranks.
Strategically, I feel CNRP would feel they've got the urban vote kind of locked down. They've probably reached all the people that they could convert. And they're really trying to go for the rural sector. And I would agree that Kem Sokha is a much better candidate for that.
Surveys conducted by the ruling Cambodian People's Party, according to government sources and diplomats, suggest it could suffer at least a 10% swing against it at the commune election. And some have suggested the swing against the ruling party could be as high as 30%.
From Pink to Pitbull, Beyonce to Bruno Mars, the hits live here on the Top 20 Countdown. Hi, I'm Ray McDonald, and for the past 30 years, I've been counting down the very best of the Billboard Hot 100 Pop Singles Chart. The hit list never sleeps, so don't you miss a moment of the action. Join me every Thursday for the Top 20 Countdown, right here and worldwide on the Voice of America.
This news alert from VOA Asia. The Philippine Foreign Secretary says ASEAN members called China's installation of weapons systems in the South China Sea very unsettling. He says the foreign ministers were unanimous in their concern, and demilitarization would be a key component of a regional code of conduct. All the big stories come your way throughout the day on VOA Asia Facebook. This is VOA Asia. As VOA Asia continues, President Donald Trump has made renegotiating global trade a key mission of his administration. His tough talk on trade has raised concerns with China, the largest U.S. trading partner. Coupled with a slowing economy, China is looking to grow trade beyond the United States. And this May, Chinese President Xi Jinping is inviting heads of several countries in Asia, Europe, and the American continent for a meeting in Beijing under the name of the One Belt, One Road Forum. VOA Asia's Steve Miller spoke with reporter Saibal Dasgupta in Beijing to learn more.
What is China hoping to achieve with its upcoming May Economic Forum?
The way China looks at it is twofold. One, China is seriously afraid that Donald Trump will start a trade war. And once that happens, none of its old friends, none of its trade partners like Europe or Russia can help. Because the U.S. is the second largest trade partner and also the trendsetter in terms of what to buy and what not to buy. The second thing that China is trying to do is that it is trying to grab a leadership position. It is It is sensing that this is a great time to show that it is able to show have leadership at a time when the Trump administration has made a lot of world leaders unhappy and a lot of businesses in Europe are very uncertain about its future.
Is this more or less a continuation of its One Belt, One Road policy?
Absolutely. In 2013, when they came up with the policy, the world didn't take notice. In 2015, when they had this meeting of 56 countries and the U.S. was trying to stop China from establishing an Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank, and the U.S. did not manage to stop China because U.K. joined and then much of Europe joined. So the Belt Initiative was sort of flagged off. But at the same time, what has happened is that China has not been able to show much demonstrable success other than in Pakistan. But this success is very important for China because through this, dozens of projects, China is trying to sell its construction company business, it is trying to sell equipment, it is trying to sell steel and cement, as well as export its own skilled workers.
May is a few months away. Do we have any inclination of who may be attending at this early stage?
Putin has already said he's going to attend. The Philippine president has said that he's going to attend. Normally, the Philippine president is not important, but now he has become very important because he is now China's voice in the South China Sea. Philippines was the only country which was directly stopping China from expanding, and it was in U.S. allies. But now the new president has come. He has turned against the U.S. and overnight is the closest Chinese supporter. And he is coming. And he also happens to be the chair of the ASEAN this year. So he is influential in that sense.
Have there been any concerns expressed about China's new role in promoting globalization and fighting against protectionism these past few weeks?
Fitch Ratings came out with an extensive report on this subject and said that most of the projects are politically motivated and driven, and these projects are not bankable. Most of these projects have been selected in areas which have either very high terrorism or heavy political uncertainty, like places in Central Asia, Myanmar, and even in Southeast Asia, South China Sea. So Fitch Ratings is saying that banks, commercial banks, are not going to support it. And those who go forward will find it very difficult to raise funds in the market because they do not have a very clear-cut business plan and there is no rate of return. So it is very clear that China doesn't want to fund it. China wants commercial banks to come and fund it. But China will have to foot a lot of bills because others may not be interested.
Saibal Dasgupta is our reporter in Beijing joining us on the phone. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thanks, Steve.
Developing at this hour in Asia, Chinese authorities have ordered all motor vehicles in a part of Xinjiang to be installed with satellite tracking devices. Police say cars are the main transportation means for terrorists and are also a frequently chosen tool to carry out terrorist attacks. Vehicles have until June 30th to comply. VOA Asia keeps you informed all day on Facebook at VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia, most experts agree that we're already past the dawn of robotic age, and one of the countries strongly pushing to the forefront is China. As the cost of human labor in China is rising, factories are increasingly replacing production line workers with robots. VOA's George Putich reports.
Almost a quarter of the manufactured products in the world today are made in China. According to the CIA's World Factbook, China ranks second on the list of nations with the greatest industrial output, the United States being the first. But that may not be the case for long. One of the reasons is that Chinese companies are increasingly replacing human workers with robots. MIT Technology Review editor Will Knight recently visited China. He spoke via Skype.
The grand plan is to, rather than to see manufacturing, you know, move to different countries as it moves, say, from the US to China, they want to hold on to it by just investing a lot in automation and robotics.
Knight says two factors contribute to the move. an open attitude towards whatever helps get things done, and a desire by Chinese workers to move away from low-skilled jobs.
I was really struck by the spirit of innovation and the speed of innovation and how everybody was on board with that. It's amazing how much the workers actually themselves were really involved with helping to redesign the production lines to introduce more mechanization, more automation.
Currently, Chinese companies are buying most of their industrial robots from US and European manufacturers. But last summer, Chinese appliance giant Midea acquired the largest share of ownership in Germany's KUKA, one of the biggest manufacturers of industrial robots. Other companies are developing their own intelligent machines.
Big companies like Foxconn, which makes the iPhone, is pouring huge amounts into developing robots, and they're really determined to make it work, make it happen.
Knight says both the Chinese government and private companies have programs designed to retrain workers who will be replaced by robots. And he adds, as the current trend towards automation continues, the US and Europe will have to step up their game if they want to keep pace with China. George Putich, VOA News, Washington.
Well, no robots on our assembly line. It's all people here. You've been listening to VOA Asia. Be sure to check us out on Facebook at the same name, VOA Asia. Our director is Tracy Carter, engineer Jimmy Cook, and our managing editor is Diane Gao. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. We invite you to come back and visit with us again tomorrow for another edition of VOA Asia. We hope you have a wonderful day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
It's been 6 years since the Iranian government arbitrarily detained three prominent political leaders without formal charges or a trial. Two of them, Mehdi Karoubi and Mir Hossein Mousavi, were candidates in the 2009 presidential election. The third is Mr. Mousavi's wife and women's rights advocate, Sahra Radnavard. Following the results of the 2009 election, many peaceful pro-democracy demonstrations brought millions of people into the streets of Tehran and other Iranian cities. The demonstrations, which came to be known as the Green Movement, were violently suppressed by the government. In February 2011, Karoubi, Mousavi, and Radnavard were detained and placed under house arrest. On the sixth anniversary of their arbitrary detention, the United States again called for their immediate release and for the release of all prisoners of conscience unjustly detained in Iran. Acting State Department spokesperson Mark Toner said in a written statement that the continued house arrest of Karoubi, Mousavi, and Radnavard contradicts Iran's international obligations, including those under the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, to which Iran is a state party, to provide minimum fair trial guarantees, and not to subject citizens to arbitrary arrest or detention. The Iranian government, Mr. Toner said, should respect human rights and fundamental freedoms of all individuals in Iran consistent with its international obligations, including ensuring the fundamental right of peaceful freedom of expression and the right to participate in civil society and in the political process without fear of arbitrary arrest and detention or denial of fair trials.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. If you have a comment, please write to Editorials, VOA, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. You may also comment and view all our current editorials at the VOA Editorials homepage, www.voanews.com/editorials.